This is a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.
Now, I'll get to the main topics that we're going to cover today in a minute, but let me just give you a bit of historical background here. In the Department of Human Development, but in Cornell in a larger sense, there's a long tradition, and Cornell is very well known for cutting-edge research that's concerned with the scientific side of the law, behavioral science, psychology, sociology, as it connects to the law. You, of course, will all know about Steve Cici's research on children's testimony. It's been widely published. Indeed, when was it? 1989. The Department of Human Development, College of Human Ecology, and the Law School here at Cornell sponsored the first scientific conference on children and the law. It was held right in the Statler. I attended, as a matter of fact. So Cornell has a very, very long tradition in this area. You'll know about people in the Department of Human Development, as I said, Steve. Another one would be Dave Dunning in the psychology department, who does eyewitness identification. Over in the law school has the lead national training program for capital cases. It's called Project Death Penalty. For some years it was directed by Sherry Johnson. She's now co-director, and it's directed by John Bloom. Sherry and John have done death penalty appeals out of the Capitol Appeal Center in South Carolina for many, many years. And John is now a tenured professor here at Cornell. He was an adjunct professor for many, many years, basically out there doing appeals. And now he's here teaching. We have a death penalty clinic and so on. And we have since I came, this is one of the main reasons I came here, we have some new course offerings in the Department of Human Development that's connected to the law at both the undergraduate and the graduate level. We have a number of undergrad majors who are going on to law school, so it serves them. And most importantly, though, we have a new PhD program that's called Law, Psychology, and Human Development. It's an interdisciplinary program within the grad school, meaning that it covers multiple colleges and multiple departments. It covers three colleges in particular: the Law School, College of Human Ecology, and Arts and Sciences, with the participating departments in those colleges being Psych on the one hand and Human Development on the other. So this program is part of the PhD training stream. It's a concentration that you can do if you're doing your PhD in human development or if you're doing your PhD in psychology. We also have arrangements so that you can do a law degree, a JD degree, as part of that PhD program if you want to, basically following the Stanford model of alternating years in JD, PhD, JD, PhD, and so on. I should mention, too, before we move on, that science in the law, social science in the law, psychology in the law, is a major new movement within the law. It's very hot at the top five law schools. Our dean has been a central player in that, dean of law, and several faculty in the law college. We have a number of people in the law school that have JDs and PhDs. Behavioral science, psychology, human development type research. So it all works very nicely together. A couple of faculty in the College of Law, Jeff Raplinsky and Valerie Hans, are part of our grad field of human development and so on. So that's sort of the administrative overview. There's a lot that's new that's going on the human development law interface. At Cornell now, that I'm going to sort of skip through lightly. What I want to do next, before we actually get to the heart of the presentation and the topics we're going to cover, is I want to give you a brief overview of the main faculty that are involved in the grad concentration in psych and in human development. What they do, what the nature of their research is, and sort of resource people that you could contact if you have questions about particular topics. The order here is alphabetical. John Bloom, as I mentioned, specializes in capital punishment and mitigation. He's argued in the final stage of appeal in a capital case, when you're operating at the level of U.S. Court or at the level of the Supreme Court, is called habeas corpus, is the technical name for the appeal. Something, and John has argued two of those appeals before the Supreme Court of the United States in the last 2 years. He won the last one, which is sort of like astonishing. So that's his specialty. He has a number of students who are law students who are involved in doing this work. Basically, they take appeal cases, they review them, they prepare the arguments and the documents for the appeal. They also do cases in the initial stages too, when they're initially being tried. So that's what John does. He does a lot of very psychological and behavioral science type research on this topic. I won't belabor this too much longer, but let me just say, capital punishment is like all psychology and human development. Because
can you define capital punishment for
us? Capital punishment?
Case, capital case. You use the term capital case.
Well, a capital case is just a case in which somebody is being tried for murder and the death penalty is on the table. We don't have to worry about that here in New York anymore. The state legislature did not pass the legislation that was designed to reintroduce capital punishment, so that's not an option when you're prosecuting a case in New York. So, I said that capital punishment and capital cases are mainly all psychology and human development. That's because, without putting too fine a point on it, when you have capital defendants, they're basically young men with very bad histories, very bad family histories, a lot of drug abuse, psychiatric problems, and so on. So a great deal of the case involves presenting this evidence, which is called mitigating evidence in a capital case. So you're going to hear what I do today, because I'm going to talk a lot about my research for the main part of the talk to illustrate the kind of work that goes on in this program. Steve Cece, who's also in the Human Development Department, is a specialist, as I am, in memory and the law, and the heart of this talk is going to be, I'm going to attempt to show you, if you don't come away from anything else in this talk, that the criminal law is mostly memory. We'll see what that means. Dave Dunning in the psychology department, whom I mentioned, is a social psychologist. He's done a great deal of work in eyewitness identification, which we will talk about today, not Dave's work, but eyewitness identification. He's a specialist in the effects of social attitudes and bias in the law. John Eckenrode, whom you know in HD, is a specialist in child abuse and neglect and its relation to the law. Valerie Hans, who is a relatively new hire over in the law school, she's been here, this will be her second year in the fall, is an expert in jury decision-making, the social psychology of jury decision-making, and bias. Jeff Reklinski, who has been a professor in the law school for some years, holds a PhD in social psychology from Stanford, as well as a JD. He teaches courses in constitutional law and things like that, and lawyering, so things that are very specialized for attorneys. Lawyering is basically how you run a law office. But he's a psychologist, and that's what his research is, and he studies legal decision-making and judicial bias. in judicial reasoning, as when they rule on motions and things like that. So if you know a bit about, or what you will have heard a bit about yesterday, Valerie's work in bias and judgment and decision making, imagine studying those same kinds of things, but studying them in U.S. district court judges, for example. That's the kind of thing that Jeff does. And then, of course, you heard Valerie's talk yesterday, and her relationship to this program is, of course, legal decision making and also risky behavior. So that's the rough overview of the people. Here's the main topics we're going to be talking about today. This is sort of the gist of what we'll be talking about today, these four topics. So don't imagine that we're going to go through these topics seriatim. These will be the themes. So the first thing I want to talk about is witnesses' memory reports. So a criminal investigation, a criminal trial, the role that people's memory reports play in that whole process. And what we're going to see is that they're very pervasive indeed. As a result of that, we're also going to talk about the fact that the memory reports that people give are very prone to false positive errors. Memory's a fallible thing, as we all know. Fallibility has two basic aspects to it. The traditional one that we think of most is we forget. We just can't remember. That's not the positive side or positive errors. The positive errors are false memories, and that is to say circumstances in which we have positive, definite memories of things that didn't happen to us. Now, that's a very important question in the law, because the law regards conviction of the innocent as being a far more serious miscarriage of justice than failing to convict the guilty. And false memory reports can lead both to conviction of the innocent, and by definition, if you convict the innocent, you let the guilty go free to reoffend. So it has both of those kinds of difficulties associated with it. So a lot of that will be running through the talk. And we'll also be saying some things about the fact that certain types of witnesses, and I'm using witness, by the way, in a very general way here, you will see as we go through, by which I mean, yeah, people that get on the stand and are sworn and testify, those are witnesses. But in general, people that provide information out of their memories for the legal process. So these can be people who are interviewed by the police, people who provide written statements or oral statements that are inputs to the investigative process. These are people who, when a prosecutor receives a batch of information from an investigation and has to make a decision, do I go forward or not, and how do I go forward? That's the realm of prosecutorial discretion. People may talk to them and provide information to them at that point that's used in the decision-making process. All those people are witnesses in a broad sense. Then the main thing we're going to talk about is lots and lots of experimental findings on these topics, most of which are from my lab, and we're going to talk about actually seven categories of research findings that bear on how the law uses and interprets evidence that comes out of people's memories. A point that I'm going to make again, but it's worth mentioning now, is that if the majority of evidence that's used to make decisions in the legal process, say a criminal trial, is memory information, then triers of fact, people that make decisions about guilt or innocence, which is juries and judges, are charged by the U.S. Constitution with making their decisions under a certain criterion, like beyond a reasonable doubt if it's criminal or if it's civil, preponderance of evidence, by weighing the credibility of the evidence that they receive. If that evidence is mainly memory evidence, what does that mean? You're going to have to make some assumptions, you, me as a juror about how memory works. That's what we're going to be talking about a lot today. Okay, I now want to benumb you with a lot of points that are designed to convince you of one thing. The law, particularly the criminal law, ain't CSI. It's not. And it's mostly about, at every stage in the process, from investigative through trial and through what goes on in the jury room, about memory. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start out and I'm just going to give you, seriatim, a whole series of examples of pieces of evidence and ways of gathering evidence in a criminal proceeding and using evidence, all of which are just obviously nothing more nor less than memory. Now, if someone reports a crime, armed robbery, and the police go out to investigate it, that's the first stage of production of evidence in the legal process. So the first kinds of things that you're going to see is evidence that's obtained by police that may then be passed on to a prosecutor. When police first go out and interview witnesses to a crime, they typically don't, in most jurisdictions, actually tape record. They go out, they get some facts, and then they go back and they write a narrative. So they write a report, and if you've ever seen police reports, at the start there's a bunch of normative stuff. What time of day was it? Who did I talk to? The nature of the crime, blah, blah, blah. Where did I go? And so on. And then there's a narrative part about what went on and what people said. Just a memory report. From your undergraduate days, it's what's called narrative free recall. It's just a memory report. Police will, as part of that, will also give not only a narrative of what it was the witnesses said about the events, they'll also give narratives of the crime scene. They may generate some suspects whom they also interview, but if the person's a suspect, the interview is usually called an interrogation and follows a certain kind of formalized set of procedures. After they've done that, whatever the questions are that they ask and whatever the information is that they got from the suspects, they write that up in a report, in a narrative. They may, as a part of an interrogation, or maybe not as part of an interrogation, maybe just a random interview out there somewhere, they may get a confession from someone. If so, they'll write a narrative of that. What's the narrative? Once again, the questions they ask, what people said in response to those questions. Another thing that police investigators do during the course of an investigation is they may have a suspect. They may want to go back and talk to the witnesses a second and third time to see if they can get an identification of their suspect. So they'll generate pictures, usually from a database. It could be from the New York State photo archive for driver's licenses, for example. They'll take photo spreads out. They'll talk to witnesses, and they'll see if witnesses can identify a suspect. Well, that whole process, once again, their report of that, what you're supposed to follow certain procedures. And the procedures that you follow, the questions you ask, the responses that the subjects made, and so on, to those field identifications, are all then written up in a memory report called a narrative afterwards. It may be days afterwards. For example, if a person, many of these kinds of things occur when a person is just going off their shift. And in that case, at the earliest, they'll be written the next morning. Another kind of memory report that often figures in legal cases is when you're out interviewing witnesses, you may interview the witnesses about what other witnesses or suspects have told them. Okay, so a witness's memory report of what other people said to them. That's hearsay, of course, and is not directly is not introducible in evidence and testimony in court, but it's very, very important information. Witnesses can also make their own written narratives, not just the police. So witnesses may sit down, or you may ask them, you may call them on the telephone, and you may say, well, you know, kind of write me out a report of what you remember went on during the course of this crime. Or witnesses may be interviewed by the police, and then after that they may be told, okay, could you write me up now, we've gone over these things, could you write me up a report of what you think happened? Now, all of that, of course, that I just described is just narratives that occur after the fact, and you may be just reviewing these written materials that people have provided. You may be reviewing other kinds of materials, too, and that are not in the nature of written reports, but are actually verbatim recordings. So you can think of all of these things that I just talked about. Imagine that you have verbatim recordings of them, audio recordings, and many take interrogation as an example. In certain jurisdictions, it is standard practice to videotape or audiotape interrogations of suspects, or to videotape or audiotape eyewitness identifications and so on. So just imagine all those things that I just said, and imagine you had you have just a parallel series in which you have verbatim recordings of all of these things. Because you have an audio tape or a videotape in front of you, is that somehow, with respect to the information that you've been given, if you see it in court, is that somehow more reliable, more accurate information than what comes in a written narrative? Question.
Well, I would say yes, because...
No. It's just a... It's just a memory report. That's the point.
It is a memory report, but the difference is that you have, in the first case, you have the police memory and you have the witness memory, so you've got two sources of error. Whereas the verbatim recording, you only have the witness source of error in memory.
That's true. That's
okay,
true.
That's
but it's still it's still unreliable because it's still just a memory report. Well, I mean, it's not... It's still under, it has the same kinds of reliability problems associated. Good point. Yes, question.
You also have the, I'm thinking not all of these, but more so if it's a written report by the police, it's subject to interpretation. And what the person said versus what the police heard and how they put it down are not going to, there's more room for error.
Yes, and you are, if you have a verbatim recording, you're able to review it, for example. And you're able to match it up against what people think was said, for example.
It's also more subject to bias.
And with reference to your point, there have actually been investigations done, a very interesting database in Israel, where a law was passed that was intended to supersede an earlier law, but the earlier law wasn't repealed, and police investigators in certain kinds of cases are under obligations both to do a written narrative and provide a tape recording, do a tape recording too. These are in investigations of child sexual abuse. So previously, they had been required to write what was called a verbatim narrative of what they asked and what the child said and so on, as soon afterwards as possible. Legislation that came along subsequently said, no, you've got to tape record these things. And now you have a very large database in which you have both. And you're able to match the narrative up against what was actually said and by way of questions and by way of responses. And what you find is that there are predictable kinds of distortion between the two. So, okay. You can have examples when it comes to witness interviews and suspect interrogations and eyewitness field identifications and confessions that are not narratives. They are the actual verbatim recordings. Still memory reports. You can also have actual written confession statements where people write out their confession, what they did, what happened, and so on, rather than a narrative report of a confession. Then as we get closer to trial itself, you can have deposition. So up to this point, everything we've covered is not sworn. It's not under oath. So in the last two stages in the process, we have member reports that are taken under oath. In most states, you're not allowed to take depositions in criminal cases. Depositions are absolutely the rule in a civil case, unless there's some sort of medical problem. Everybody is deposed, often multiple times. In the case of criminal cases, there are some states that allow pretrial depositions. Missouri is one, for example. And then finally, you have courtroom testimony itself, where you give another member report, only you give it under oath.
So,
question?
Yes. The deposition then is just under oath.
Yeah, but it's not the basic difference between a deposition and sworn courtroom testimony is the following. First of all, we're sitting around in a room like this, across from the table, and the opposing counsel are there. And the examination is conducted entirely by the opposing counsel. It's information the opposing counsel wants to get to prepare her case. Your counsel, whatever side you're on, is not permitted to object. Only on form. So you have to, and the judge is available by telephone. And if things get really nasty, then the judge may be called in to, if the attorney that's doing the questioning gets into a real fishing expedition, what did your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather do in the Revolutionary War, or something like that, people may get all upset, and usually they don't do that because they're time-limited. So, anyway. And all that information is given under oath. A lot of it will never make it into court, though, if you then testify in court, because the other attorney is now allowed to object in court to questions on a number of different grounds. So, for example, you can ask me leading questions in a deposition. You can't do that in court, and so on. So that's it. They're both sworn, but one's in court in front of a jury. Not always in front of a jury, but that's the difference. Finally, so we've seen a lot about how all the evidence is produced and then given in court by normal everyday folks like us in the form of memory reports, but I said it ain't CSI in the criminal law, and that even includes physical and forensic evidence, because in a criminal trial, physical and forensic evidence has to be itself presented in the form of testimony. So even though you produce documents and you produce how many jurors understand the results of chemical tests, for example? Well, they're not going to. Even though they're going to get the results and be able to take them into the jury room, they have to be explained and interpreted. And the procedures that were used have to be explained on the stand. So all of that is memory reports, and we have many examples in the law of cases that have been in which incorrect physical and forensic evidence has been introduced as a result of memory failures. So a forensic expert may not actually be able, or may misremember or misinterpret the scientific literature on a particular point, for example, and then that information goes directly to the jury. So there's the point. There's the bottom line. It's the bulk of the evidence in criminal cases.
Oh.
Yes? Well, what?
Okay.
It's just the bulk of the evidence in criminal cases at every stage, not only in the courtroom. Investigative process. Then when the investigative process is complete or partially complete, the information goes to the prosecutor to decide what to do. prosecutor may gather some more information, but the prosecutor's decision-making is controlled by that information, which is memory reports. Then if charges are filed, the defense attorney comes into the situation to figure out how to defend the person, using the same information, but perhaps gathering more information. That's also memory reports as well. All of that happens before you actually arrive at the trial. Interestingly enough, there was a study that bears on this point. A couple of studies conducted by a couple of sociologists, Horvath and Miesig, in the late 1990s. They actually wanted to get some numbers that would allow you to say, okay, in what percentage of the criminal cases out there do you have anything other than memory reports as evidence? So, as a kind of first pass, they took a sample of criminal cases in the United States, and they just looked at whether or not any physical forensic evidence was gathered in the cases. You know, was there a weapon? Was there tissue samples? Was there fingerprints? And so on. And what they found was that physical forensic evidence was gathered in less than 10% of the criminal cases in the United States. It wasn't even available to be used. It wasn't gathered. Then, of the less than 10% of criminal cases in which some sort of physical forensic evidence was gathered, they found that it was processed less than 50% of the time. Now, processed, it's with a D, not with an S. Processed can mean a number of things. The technical term is processed to a forensic standard, which means you could use it. So a lot of things, so even when it's gathered, a lot of things happen or don't happen that prevent it from actually being used in court. You have to have an established trail of evidence, possession of evidence, for example. So appropriate records might not be kept. You might not be able to establish the chain, so then it can't be used. It might become contaminated. It might become lost, for example, and so on. Or you might be able not to hook it up with who you got it from. So there's lots of reasons that make it unusable by the time you get to trial. And here's the most interesting thing of all, which loads the law in favor of memory evidence. It turns out that this is really counterintuitive, because you and I, as we sit here, of course, would regard, okay, you know, if you had a picture of the clock showing what time it was with the body laying under it, well, that would be hugely more reliable than somebody saying, oh, well, it was 12:10, which we sort of know people can do, right? Or, you know, if you have a picture of the thermometer showing, it was 82 degrees and the clock at 2:30, you know, that's got to be hugely more reliable than somebody saying, it was 105, you know, and it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But criminal investigators, don't behave in accordance with that rule. The modal opinion of physical investigators is that physical evidence itself has little intrinsic value. And investigators use it not in the way you'd think, oh, this is it, this is the gold standard, this is the key thing that we're going to present to a jury, but rather as an adjunct to interviews that generate memory reports from people. They use it, for example, as a source of impeachment of people. Okay, now it can't be quite like that because we have this other evidence that shows this and that. You know, the doctor said this, so it can't be like that. It must be something else to sort of shape the story in a consistent kind of way. That's how they prefer to use physical evidence.
What is that?
Why is that?
As you say, it's counterintuitive.
Well, the main reason is, for me, is that physical evidence is messy. It doesn't necessarily tell a consistent story. You can get people to tell a consistent story that's compelling to the jury. But evidence can go, physical evidence can go in all kinds of different directions. Okay, so now remember, you don't know what happened. Okay, let's back up. There are no facts when it, you know, the what happened, the crime itself, the physical energy that was involved in the crime is like out around Mars somewhere. Okay, so unless there's a video recording, unless it was in a bank with a video recording, for example, you don't know what happened. But you got to have a story of what happened if you're going to prosecute the crime, and if the jury's going to convict. By the way, even if you have a bank video of a crime, it's hard to tell what's going. I've had cases in which we had a bank video of the robber, and people couldn't tell who it was, with a series of photo spreads. I mean, even that evidence is not that good. But let's leave that on one side. Physical evidence, actual physical facts can go all over the place. They don't necessarily all converge on the same story. And that's a problem when you're talking to the jury, trying to present a case. But you can get people to agree on a story. So.
When you were talking about those numbers, the 10% gathered mm-hmm. and less than 50% named, it really brings to mind to me, since you were saying those things, how much less reliable all of that becomes when you hear of the cases where it's so rarely done that you can gather the evidence, and then if you find out it's been tampered with by the police force. I mean, I'm thinking in particular, actually, if my memory is correct, it may not be, but the Paris family murders.
Yeah, Shirley King.
And the gas can and the fingerprints that really played a major part in the conviction, and then it's found to have been tampered with by the police force.
Well, there's no. What I said a minute ago has no implications about the police tampering with
that.
I mean, when it comes to the issue of the 50% of it that isn't processed to a forensic standard, remember, if somebody tunes up the evidence, tunes it up,
yeah.
Okay, that's going forward. That's getting into court. See, we're talking about, for the most part, just simple
right.
failures, just not doing the job in the right way, just not remembering to you're out there, you know, it's the heat of the day, it's Tucson, you know, it's 125 in the afternoon, and you're trying to interview the witnesses outside the convenience store, and somebody forgets to take the pictures, you know? Or somebody remembers to take the pictures and loses the camera. Or they upload them to the computer and then they can't remember which computer it was, and so on and so on. Or the law says it has to be a police computer. It's all documented and everything. Well, you didn't do that, you put it on a private computer. All these kinds of things.
So those are those things that sometimes they get ruled out just because it didn't follow right.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, or a simple thing is you have a piece of evidence and you got it from a witness, but you can't remember which one. And it ain't easy in most kinds of crimes to get a hold of witnesses. They tend to not be from a stable social stratum. So, so what all of this adds up to, I think, and what we're mostly going to talk about is this. We have to be concerned about the reliability of memory in general, and we have to be particularly concerned about people who can have vulnerable memories. Children, the aged, people with medical impairments, for example. Now we're going to move to the main point of the talk, or the research that I'm going to talk about. Since the evidence is mostly memory reports, and since we know that we're not dealing with perfect information, But yet, as a juror, we don't have an out. We have to use that information. That's our constitutional obligation. You process this information, judge its credibility, and that's how you make your decision. You just can't do that unless you make some assumptions about how memory works. If you have this report here and this report here, and they conflict in major or minor ways, you have to be able to say, oh, okay, which one's more credible? That's what you're charged with doing. And you could throw up your hands, too, and say, I don't know, but you're supposed to, and that can be a credibility assessment. But to make those kinds of assessments, you have to make some assumptions. You may not be able to articulate them, but you have to make some assumptions about how memory works. So you can say, ah, this memory is apt to be better than that memory. I'm going to talk about 7 of these assumptions, common ones that juries use, and we're going to talk about research on them. We'll talk about the assumptions first, and then we'll move to 7 research programs that illustrate what science has found out. A lot of it done here at Cornell. And on all of these topics, a lot of it done here at Cornell. Here's the first assumption. We're going to call it the developmental competence principle, and we're going to talk about it first because we're all interested in kids. And that is, when it comes to these reliability problems with memory reports, but particularly the problem of reporting incorrect information as opposed to just forgetting, that children are particularly problematical witnesses, that they're particularly prone to making false memory reports. And this idea, the scientific basis for this idea, was first generated here at Cornell in the 1989 conference that I mentioned in Children in the Law, was designed to feature the scientific literature on this result. And as many of you also know, some early reversals of high-profile convictions, such as the Kelly Michaels case, in which children had provided evidence that the appeal court subsequently decided was tainted evidence, those cases were, well, they weren't spawned here at Cornell, but the appeals were spawned here at Cornell, and the scientific background from them was done by Cornell professors. So this is a big thing for us. Second kind of idea. Eyewitness identifications figure very centrally in criminal cases. That guy over there, he's the one that I saw at the convenience store. And so you're going to be confronted with that as a juror. You're going to be confronted with witnesses on the stand who are the prosecutor is going to come up and going to say, do you remember when Officer Jones showed you this photo spread? Yes. Who did you pick out of this photo spread? I picked this person right here. Were you confident in your? Yes, I was 95% sure that was the person I saw at the convenience store when the robbery happened. Do you see that person in court today? Yes, he's sitting right there. Well, actually right there. If the jury's here, he'd be right there. Sorry, the prosecution gets to sit closest to the jury and kind of give them the high sign. So you're going to be confronted with that kind of evidence all the time. An assumption that juries make, and there's whenever I say juries assume, there's research on that. There's people that do research, as I said, on jury decision making who study what it is that jurors assume. Well, jurors assume that if they've got an eyewitness up there who's making a confident and did make earlier a confident eyewitness identification, that this is very reliable, very probative evidence of guilt, except maybe if the witness is a child or perhaps an aged person. The next one, this is number one on the hit parade. Confessions. That confession statements, when you get confession statements, that they are very reliable evidence of guilt. So people that confess to a, all on their own or to a police interrogator, that is very reliable evidence of guilt. And that it's reliable evidence of guilt in adolescents and children as well as adults. The idea here is, of course, the implicit assumption is people are not going to falsely confess to things they didn't do because they're going to get hammered. So, of course, they're not going to confess to things that they didn't do.
They're getting hammered into confessing.
Now, okay, all right. States have laws about this. And whenever you have a confession, particularly in a capital crime, but in a major felony, you have you'll have a state statute that says you can't have confessions come in as evidence that are coerced or are unduly coercive. The language differs from one jurisdiction to another. Now, what happens is in the preliminary hearing, say it's a capital case, this will take place maybe 6 months before the actual trial. The confession and the conditions under which it is obtained are reviewed. And then the judge rules, do I let this confession in or don't I? So you can't. So there is a review of it. Next. Witness admonitions. One thing we do in order to get reliable information is we admonish witnesses to only tell the truth. Okay? The whole truth and nothing but the truth. There's a special kind, so we all know about that oath. There's a special kind of witness admonition, though, that applies to children. Children, as you will already know, are supposed to be interviewed in a gentler kind of way. Now, this doesn't happen. It doesn't happen the majority of the times and so on. But there's children who are going to be witnesses and are going to provide evidence are supposed to be interviewed under different ground rules, ideally by someone who's trained in the forensic interviewing of children, CPS person, for example. Now, as I said, it doesn't happen all the time. Doesn't even happen a majority of times. That's what's supposed to happen. Well, how do you substitute? What do you do to ensure that you get the same kind of admonition for children? Well, there's something called a truth and lies ceremony that in state-of-the-art child forensic interviewing protocols like the NICHD protocols is used and is widely used around the country. And basically what happens is at the start of an interview of a child, you talk about general things and so on. You get warmed up and at some point, you're going to want to make the transition to talking about the substantive things that you actually want information about. At that point, you usually have what's called a truth and lies ceremony, in which you discuss truth and lies first. You understand. You establish that children know the distinction between those, and then you do something formal to agree that only the truth is going to be told. This child stands up, shakes the interviewer's hand, maybe signs a piece of paper, you know, or puts an X on a piece, something formal. Not an oath, but it's a formal ceremony. The assumption here is that this ensures that any false information that you get is going to be lies for the most part, because you've admonished people to only report stuff that's the truth. Yes?
I just wanted to define a couple of acronyms. CPS is Child Protective Services, and NICHD is National Institute for Child Health and Human Development.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so let's go on to the remaining four assumptions that juries make. The non-coercion principle. We know that certain witnesses, like children, are vulnerable to suggestion and they're vulnerable to coercion. And I mentioned that children are supposed to be and other vulnerable witnesses are supposed to be interviewed under special investigative rules. Basically, what these rules are ones that, I mean, we could spend a whole lecture on the NICHD protocols, for example, but the gist of it is that the interviews are supposed to not be suggestive and not be coercive and not be leading, that the children are supposed to present their own evidence in their own way. That's the idea. So we'll call those neutral kinds of interviews. Now, the non-coercion principle, which applies not only to these vulnerable witnesses, this assumption, but also to non-vulnerable witnesses and adults that juries make, is just basically that as long as interviews are not coercive, they don't taint people's memories. Okay? They don't increase the incidence. If you just have a neutral, non-coercive, a supportive, positive kind of interview about events, that doesn't distort people's memories. Indeed, it has the opposite effect. As you know, if you test yourself, if you're getting ready for an examination, you know, and you read the information yesterday, and then you test yourself this morning, you take a test, you tend to remember it better. That's the idea, that if you do that kind of interview and you get rid of the suggestion and coercion business, it doesn't taint your memory. So therefore, the idea is if you go out and you interview a child in this kind of way, talk about events, and then maybe before trial, maybe a week or so later, you come and interview them again and so on in this neutral and supportive kind of way, that it's not going to taint their memories, that it's just going to really preserve accurate reports. Consistency principle. This is sort of number two on the hit parade. It's a very mechanical kind of procedure, but important. As a juror, you're often confronted with conflicting reports, as we know, of witnesses on the stand. Now, in a criminal investigation, you will usually have police reports or sometimes even recordings of what those witnesses said about the same events on previous occasions. You're able to compare them. And if a witness has made an inconsistent statement, this will be pointed out to you, certainly by the cross-examining attorney. But you said on July the 1st, blah, blah, blah. Now you're saying this. So you get these kinds of inconsistent reports on critical details. The assumption that the jury makes, of course, is that, okay, witness A, who said the same thing on both occasions, that's more credible than witness B, who said opposite things on two occasions, or at least different things on two occasions. The assumption is that true information is more stable in your memory, and therefore more likely to be consistently reported. Why? Because it actually happened. And then finally, the reality principle, which is the simplest of all, and that is that things that actually happened, when you're trying to remember what happened, you're much more likely to report, or you're always more likely to report, things that actually happened than things that didn't happen. Well, okay, these all seem pretty reasonable. That's why juries use them, but are any or all of them true? We need a little theory first, and then we'll really get up to speed. We need a little theory, and we need a little theory about what science says about how memory actually works, as opposed to this kind of pastiche of common sense assumptions we've been talking about. There has been a lot of work on memory distortion in the last 10 to 15 years. It's been the single most intensively studied topic in the science of human memory in the last 10 or 15 years. So we have some ideas about how the brain generates false memories for things that didn't actually happen to us. We've gathered these kinds of ideas into a theory that's called fuzzy trace theory, whose main idea is that you have memory processes that oppose each other when you're talking about trying to remember what happened. two things. First thing, it appears that the brain in different areas stores at least a couple of separate records of our experience, which for lack of better terminology we call verbatim memories and gist memories. Verbatim memories are memories for the actual details of your experience. You know, the color, the taste, the smell, the physical reality, and maybe some mental reality that you sort of added to it. So what you're wearing today, you know, what you're wearing, the color of what you're wearing would all be physical to what's on the tables here, verbatim memories, and you may be having thoughts that you're adding to those things like, God, this is a boring talk. Boy, am I hungry, and these kinds, that would count too. That counts too. Those are verbatim memories too. Then there are gist memories. These are interpretations of your experience. You are meaning makers. In parallel, while your brain is storing records of the actual physical form of your experience, it is interpreting and plumbing the meaning of experience. This is not a baseball game, for example. And the brain is also storing a record of that, and we're just going to call that a gist memory. It's memory for the meaning content of your experience, and that has a lot of, meaning means a lot of different things too. We're going to just skip that part. What research suggests is that these two kinds of memories oppose each other when it comes to remembering the details of your experience. In particular, retrieving and processing verbatim memories of experience not only helps you remember what actually happened, but it helps you suppress false memory reports. Okay? It helps you suppress false memories as well. It's obvious it helps you remember true memories, things that actually happened. But it helps you suppress false memories. Why? If somebody says to you, did you have a gooey, sticky bun here this morning? And you can clearly remember, no, I had a bagel. Or, no, I had a muffin. You can say, no. Boom, that didn't happen to me. On the other hand, if you like sticky buns and you can't actually remember what it was you had here for breakfast in the morning, you can see that you're in a little bit of a problem. You don't have something automatic you can use to suppress it. Didn't eat a hot dog at the baseball game because I clearly remember that soggy slice of pizza. But suppose you can't remember what you had to eat. Well, hot dog seems reasonable. So that's how verbatim memories have to be. Now, when it comes to fomenting false memories, the causative mechanism for false memories, it's the gist traces, the gist memories that you're storing. Because your false memories of things that didn't happen are by and large consistent with the meaning content of your experience. So if you experienced an armed robbery at the grocery store on Saturday night, the false memories that you, false reports that you may have will probably involve things like rough-looking characters and bad language and weapons and money and people running in and out and that sort of thing. Probably you won't falsely remember Santa Claus in the parking lot. Just not consistent with the gist of what was going on. So, let's say one thing positive, though, before we move on. What happens with time, of course, as we all know, is your verbatim memories of the actual details of your experience fade out. You're left with the gist of experience. So the gist of experience is also a source of true memory as well as false memory. Let's just continue to bear that in mind. Okay, we're going to talk about the developmental competence principle, and I'm going to spend a fair amount of time on that. And research has been conducted here at Cornell in the past few years by some of the same people that reported the other stuff. What we've been discovering is that this idea that false reports and false memories simply decline with age is much more limited than we thought. And that, in fact, there are circumstances which are very common in daily life and in criminal cases in which we're able to demonstrate that the tendency to falsely remember things that didn't happen really increases dramatically with age, and that young children are much less error-prone and more reliable than adolescents and adults are. To lead up to that research, so that's the first research topic that we're going to talk about today. I just want to talk a bit about this kind of standard false memories, false reports decrease with age finding. It's especially prominent because of children, the concerns about the reliability of children's testimony in the child law literature. Steve Ceci and Maggie Bruck have contributed a lot of work in this area. Here, Gail Goodman and Maria Zaragoza are other examples of people who've contributed a lot of work on this topic. And it's a cornerstone of expert testimony in criminal and civil cases when you have children presenting evidence. Bottom line, expert scientific witnesses is in the position of saying, based until recently, based on the scientific literature, okay, other things being equal, if you have a story by a child and a story by an adult and they differ, they conflict in details, other things being equal, meaning I don't know anything else that's relevant, the adult story is more reliable because of the science showing that memory distortions decrease with age. The question is, since we have theory and we have science and we don't have to just run around in the dark, from our understanding of how memory works, could we actually predict that the opposite might be true? The answer is, yes, we can. We can predict, based on even these simple ideas about memory, that your tendency to report things that didn't happen to you, which remember are things primarily that are consistent with the gist, your understanding of the gist of your experience, you could get this quite easily under a couple of conditions, maybe. The obvious one is that whatever these gist memories are that foment false reporting, they develop very, very slowly. They involve interpretations of experience that a 5 or 6 year old wouldn't make, but a 20-year-old would. That's obvious. That just means that the younger witnesses just don't have the positive basis supporting the false reports. That one's really obvious. We can throw this one too into as a backup, which would help things. What's going to happen is, of course, both of these kinds of memories improve dramatically with age. So obviously, your verbatim memory gets better with age. Experimental demonstration, you have a 5-year-old and a 20-year-old study a list of 20 concrete nouns, things like snake and tree and sidewalk and computer and so on, chair, and then you say, recall as many of them as you can. The 20-year-old is going to recall maybe 3 or 4 times as many as the 5-year-old will recall. So verbatim memory improves dramatically with age. So this ability to use, remember what actually happened to you, the verbatim doesn't suppress those false reports, is getting better and better with age. Well, if you had a situation in which it was hard for the older person to use that ability for some reason, then you have something that helps you set the stage for, oh, the false memory reports could increase with age because we've tied the verbatim memory skill hand behind the person's back. So you can't use these improvements in the negative suppressive process as you get older. You're getting better at it, but you just can't use it. So there's been a great deal of research, as I said, here at Cornell in the past few years on this possibility. I'm going to show you some data, but let me just tell you the kind of conclusions that have emerged from it. The conclusion that's emerged from it is that there just isn't a monolithic age decline in reporting things that didn't happen to you. That assumption is just wrong or severely limited. The reason is, as I just mentioned, is that verbatim memory and gist memory, which creates false reports, both increase with age. And so you can look for situations in everyday life that might satisfy those two conditions that I just described and kind of generate a recipe for producing what we would think would be a counterintuitive increase in false reports of things that didn't happen to you. Here are the two principles that I just mentioned in somewhat more general terms. Now, here are some data from one of the earliest studies of this phenomenon. Let me describe the task to you and how it satisfies these two conditions. You have subjects listen to lists of words. And the words, they're 12 to 15 item lists, and the words are all semantically related to each other. They share meaning. So they're lists like nurse, hospital, sick, ill, disease, stethoscope, physician, syringe, office. Get it? And in designing these lists, you carefully leave out a prototype item that fits with that theme like a lock and a key, a key and a lock. What's the word in that case that I didn't say? Bingo. Okay. So let's try another one. How about sugar, tooth, good, pie? This one's a little harder. Tart, dessert, which, yeah, sweet. Exactly. Sweet. Very, very good. This indicates high intelligence. Okay? Because when you see these data, you're going to say, you do really bad things if you're really smart. And yeah, that's the story. So this was a preliminary series of experiments that Valerie and I conducted with a wonderful graduate student at the University of Arizona, Tammy Forrest, where we did this kind of task and I'm not going to give you all the gory methodological details of what we did, but basically we used this kind of task with subjects of different age levels using that very age range in which in other kinds of research false memory reports just disappeared. And we did things like recall, or listen to the list, recall it, listen to another list, recall it, listen to a list, recall it, listen to a list. And then we also did recognition. Listen to a bunch of these lists, and then you get a recognition test. Was this word on the list? Was that word on the list? Was this word on the list? And so on. Then the question was, of course, true memory is getting better and better with age. Whether it's the recall measure, you're recalling a lot more with age, whether it's the recognition measure, you're making more hits with age. That's improvement. Forget that. The question is, what about these things like doctor and sweet and smoke and window and chair and these kinds of things? What happens to them? Well, if our assumption is correct, children should be much more prone to that sort of thing than adults are. Okay, they think they heard doctor when they didn't. In fact, actually, absolutely the opposite is true, as the theory predicts, not as common sense and the law predicts. I'm not going to tell you any more about the details of those experiences. I just threw everything into a slide that gives you the overall picture of these experiments. The subjects range from age 5 to adult. The black bars are your tendency to have to falsely report these things on a recall test. And the white bars are your tendency to falsely recognize these things. So doctor comes up, did you hear doctor? Yes. Did you hear sweet? Yes. And there's a nice change with age. Change in recall is even statistically, percentage-wise, is even more dramatic than the change in recognition. If you look at recall and you look at 5-year-olds and 7-year-olds, there's basically no tendency to falsely recall doctor and suite. It's way down near floor. You just basically don't have to worry about that happening with 5 and 7 year olds. Whereas when you get up to college students, it's happening about 42% of the time. Okay. A former student of mine, plug my former students, said, "Well, okay, maybe this is only restricted to this kind of task that we just described. How about if we use taxonomic categories?" A taxonomic category is things like animals, right? So a bunch of animal names, a bunch of articles of clothing, a bunch of color names, and so on. So you listen to a list, red, blue, brown, and so on, and we very cleverly leave off this list a particular color, maybe yellow. And then we do the same thing. We have them recall the list after they say, or we give them a recognition test. Well, what happens? Well, what Mark found was he studied kids in the age of 5 to young adolescents, 11-year-olds, and the rectangles are this task that I just described, taxonomic categories. The thing, the little ellipses, the associates, are the other tasks that I just described in the first study, and they basically show the same kind of pattern. About a one-third increase just in this short period of time in your tendency to falsely remember these things as having been on the list. There's a study that's coming out this month, and I'll quit with these kinds of data that Valerie and I conducted, where basically we looked at the following kind of thing. Well, maybe I won't say so much about it. Basically, what we showed in these kinds of tasks is that, you might be saying, ooh, gee, why is it that kids are so low on this stuff? Because they know what red is. You know, why is it that they're not getting the meaning the way adults are and having these false memories? Well, they do get the meaning of red, and they do get the meaning of yellow, and they do get the meaning of window, and so on. The thing is, there's something that they don't do, that we do. When we get several exemplars of a meaning, we not only get the meaning of each individual once, but we connect the meaning across items so that we're able to come away and say 2 weeks from now, she says, I can't remember any of those words that I heard, but it was a lot of colors on the list. That's what you mean by a semantic relation. And basically what we showed in this research was that in these kinds of tasks, that age increase is due to that. These are a series of parallel tasks in which if you look at the things that go up with age, the false memories that go up with age, it's for tasks that have that feature. And if you look at the bottom lines, which go down with age, they're tasks in which they don't have that feature. You just get one. So imagine nurse and then doctors on the test. Well, it's going to go down with age. But imagine nurse, hospital, sick, ill, disease, stethoscope, physician, office, it's going to go up with age. That's that kind of interpretation of the connection between the elements of your experience. That's what little kids lack, and it apparently is producing this effect. Okay, let's move on quickly. Six more effects shown at fusion speed. The eyewitness identification. The assumption that eyewitness identification, particularly if it's positive, is highly reliable, is really known to be false. The data show that even in adults, eyewitness identifications are powerfully distorted by a whole series of factors, and I don't really have time to go into them, but an enormous number of factors have been studied that impair eyewitness identifications. The problem with eyewitness identification is that they're a prime example of this problem of your verbatim memory going away with time. You have to have they're going to show you it was a convenience store robbery and it was a person in their early 20s of a particular ethnic category, of a particular height, and a particular build. They're going to show you 6 FET categories when they think they've got a suspect, all of which are like that. 6 people that are all of which are like that. So you've got to get it exact. Your verbatim has to be exactly accurate. Because if they don't do that, it's called an unfair lineup and they throw it out. Okay? We also know that identification accuracies are not are poorly related, poorly correlated with your confidence that it's a correct identification. And we also know that over 90% of false convictions in the United States have positive, by Justice Department statistics, have positive eyewitness identifications. Here's some quick data. Let me just tell you quickly. Ralph and Lynn Haber out of the University of California actually went to the scientific literature and culled out experiments on eyewitness identification that were conducted under what we would call the best conditions. By best conditions, we mean basically none of this stuff or most of it wasn't present. They were conducted promptly, they weren't suggested, they weren't manipulated, and so on. And what they found was under best, and then what they did is they calculated the error rate. There's two kinds of errors in an eyewitness identification. There's a false positive and a false negative. So a false positive is the police show you a lineup that's got their suspect in it, but he's not the guy. Okay, and you say, that's the guy. That's called a witness, a suspect absent lineup. That's always the defense theory. Then there's the always prosecution theory. That's where we show you a lineup. The suspect is the perpetrator. You pick them out. Okay. Well, if you don't doing anything other than that on the second kind is an error. On the first kind of lineup, saying anybody there did it is an error. And what Haber and Haber found was in these best studies is that it's just a coin flip. That in either one of those cases, so there's defense theory, prosecution theory. The white bar is the correct response rate, and the black bar is the error rate, that if you're a juror and you're given that piece of information, you might as well flip a coin as to whether or not it's correct. Either way, it doesn't help you in either direction. Haber and Haber said, well, there's some disturbing implications of this. The first is, if you're innocent, don't let your face appear in a lineup, because it's 50% you're going to get chosen, they said. And here's a couple of cases I remember from Arizona, the Gonzalez case and the Wagner case, but both of which young men were arrested and prosecuted and lost their jobs and went tens of thousands of dollars in debt because of a false positive eyewitness identification that was later, fortunately, overturned before trial. And Haber and Haber said, but on the end, if you're guilty, go for it. Because you got a 50-50 chance of the person saying, didn't do it. Then finally, children actually can be more accurate than adults. And they're not automatically less accurate than eyewitness identification. And here's the, does anybody know which case these two guys are from? It's been out of the news just a little while. It's the Elizabeth Smart case.
The brothers that killed their parents?
No.
The guy who came through the window, the guy who came through the screen and took the girl out of the...
Died in jail. Long before Elizabeth Smart turned up in Sandy, Utah. The guy on the left, Mitchell, is the guy that actually did it, whom she was found with. A friend of ours, Gene Boylan, has anybody ever heard of Gene Boylan? She's a very well-known forensic artist. Used to work for the FBI. She came in and Elizabeth's younger sister gave her descriptions of the person who abducted Elizabeth. And on that basis, Jean produced a sketch that looks very much like Mitchell, not at all like Ricky. The police never used it and never circulated it because they thought that he was the guy. Well, okay, false confession. We got time to talk about false confession. A false confession is a self-incriminating statement that's made by a suspect. It's not, a false confession is not, I did it, take me away. You need three things. You need motive, you need method, and you need opportunity. So a false confession is where you make statements that fill in one or more of those blanks. So that maybe you had the opportunity, maybe you had the method, but you have no motive for doing it. Or maybe you had a motive, and maybe you had the method, but you couldn't have had an opportunity to do it, and so on. And I've given some examples from some cases I've worked on, murder cases in which you had what was called, so, and once you have that, the prosecutor can go into the well and represent that as a confession. He can say, you know, you will hear Mr. DeBord confess out of his own mouth to this. But basic, but what he was confessing to was a motive for doing it. So I've given you some examples of, as I said, three cases in which two of them were there, but the third wasn't, and certain statements were elicited that filled in the other blank. That's the evidence that the self-incriminating statements. So four or five self-incriminating statements, confession. We know that the confession, this idea that you don't confess unless and don't make self. So first of all, we know that confessing is making self-incriminating statements, recalling things that are self-incriminating. We know people recall false information that's self-incriminating. And it's sufficiently well known that we actually have in the scientific literature three categories of false confessions. They're called spontaneous, coerced compliant, and coerced internalized. And each of them is studied in their own right. Spontaneous confessions are people just come in and confess. And they write letters, they make telephone calls, say, I did it. And these are most common in celebrity murders, and the most famous example of that that produced over 100 false confessions was over 100, something like 120.
Yeah. She said JonBenet.
No. JonBenet Ritz? No. Lindbergh baby. Lindbergh baby in the 30s. A coerced compliant confession is when in police interrogation, false statements, self-incriminating statements are forced out, come out during a police interrogation that are false, but the person knows they're false when they make them. They make them for other reasons, like social compliance. But they know they're false. And these typically produce recantations. I've given you examples of cases. And the final one is coerced internalized. These are cases in which people make false statements, false self-incriminating statements, and they remember the things that's actually happened. And the Paul Ingram case and also the DeBord case in Illinois are just examples of such cases. If you want to look into them on the web, you just type in these things and you get them. Yes? Yes, I know. quickly. Here's some. If you want to look up in the Chicago Tribune, 2001, type it in, Chicago Tribune, search under Armstrong, Mills, and Posley. You'll find a wonderful article of 247 false confessions in capital cases in Chicago that are thrown out. Some other examples. Here's a local example that you'll remember from about a year ago. Douglas Warney, who falsely confessed to murder 10 years ago, being freed by DNA evidence. Now, here, this one's a test. Remember him?
Yes.
Who?
Yep.
John Mark Carr. John Mark Carr.
JonBenet
Ramsey. Yeah. We don't know what happened to him because the interrogation took place over, where was it, Thailand? So we don't know what kind of thing it was, but we know, apparently, that what was said was not true and was inconsistent with what, or at least some of the things he said, couldn't have stood in prosecution. We know that children and adolescents are particularly prone to false confession because children are highly prone to persuasion, which occurs in interrogation and police interviewing. And adolescents are particularly prone, research shows, to a particular kind of false confession that involves altruism. In those 247 cases in Chicago, for example, there was a large slice of them that were adolescent confessions. And the way they get adolescents to confess, if the following kinds of things happen in a police interrogation, an adolescent is increasingly likely to confess. And that is that they feel that by confessing, they're going to help people. And they're going to help their family. They think their father did it, so they confess to it to protect the family. Or they don't know who did it, but they think it will be better for the family better for their school, and better for their friends if they confess. So children and adolescents, highly prone. Another problem with confession is that, and this is the worst news of all, that when you make false statements under pressure, even if you know they're false at the time, they taint your memories, and you tend to remember them as true later on. So Maria Zaragoza did a number of experiments on this, on what's called the forced confabulation effect. And basically what she did experiments in which people had some experiences, then right away she interviewed them and she forced them to confabulate things that were pretty serious things, like blood and injuries and so on, right afterwards. They knew those things were wrong. But then she retested their memories about what actually happened a week later, 2 weeks later. And what happened is now they tended to falsely remember those things as having happened. Well, I'm going to have to end now. I'm not going to talk about the other three effects. Phantom recollection is, and I don't mind this terribly because I wanted to take more time at the start.
Dr. Brainerd, I noticed that the snack's not here, so you might have a little more time. Let me check
on
the snack.
Keep talking.
All right. But I'm going to step along because I don't want people to go out here and say, "Oh, that Brainerd, you." Okay. We know that the witness admonition assumption is also wrong because there's an area of research known as phantom recollection. What this scientific literature, and I'm not going to go into the details again, but let me say, what it has shown is this, is that when you have a false memory, oftentimes it very much emulates the phenomenology of a true memory. Now, when you have a true memory, something that actually happened, where you can smell that hot dog and you can taste it, you know, it's salty and it's not too hot and the bun is soggy and all of that. That's vivid phenomenology that accompanies things that actually happen to you. Well, you'd say, well, you know, false memory couldn't be like that. You'd have phenomenologically, even if you thought it happened, it would sort of be experienced as an inference because it didn't really happen. It, consistent with the gist of my experience, it didn't really happen. So it's sort of like a deduction or inference. Well, unfortunately, that's not the way memory works. A lot of examples of false memory are supported by an illusory, vivid phenomenology. You hear the words in the voice in which they were not pronounced. You hear doctor. I mean, did any of you hear doctor ringing in your ear? Well, that's what subjects tend to do. Now what? That problem, that foils truth-telling admonitions. You can only tell that something is false and didn't happen if you can somehow discriminate those just consistent things that didn't happen from the things that did happen that are just consistent, right? Well, what's the basis for that? Well, in everyday life, we use this phenomenology stuff. That's what we do out there in the real world. We process that phenomenological information to okay, that really happened. I'm not so sure about that. It foils that.
Dr. Brainerd, our snack is actually the snack.
It is here. All right. Okay. All right. Well, we're going to skip to this. Okay. First of all, that evidence in criminal proceedings is really weighted toward memory reports, and they're obtained in a whole lot of different ways. And that juries have to fulfill a constitutional obligation. In order to do that, since they're being confronted with memory reports, they've got to make some assumptions about how memory works. And they just have to do it. Problem is that psychological research shows that the memory assumptions that are made by juries are questionable, including assumptions that they make about vulnerable people, like children and youth. With respect to the seven things that we started out with, although you didn't see the last three, we know that a couple of them, which you did see, are fundamentally invalid. The idea that eyewitness identification, particularly confident ones, are highly reliable is just, that's not the story, scientifically. The idea that non-coerced confessions are highly reliable evidence of guilt, also not true. People make false self-incriminating statements. Over 10%, nearly 15% of false convictions in the United States by Justice Department standards have what I described earlier as a false confession as part of them. And there are particular problems with false confession in children and youth because of the susceptibility to persuasion on the one hand and altruistic self-incrimination on the other. And then the other ones, the other four, there's very serious limitations to them. So that when you're in the courtroom and when evidence is, when you would want to make these assumptions to interpret the evidence, the juries really do have to be instructed about what the science is, because the assumptions themselves can only be applied in limited circumstances. Now, all of this stuff that I talked about and the stuff that I didn't get to talk about, you can access it all right here. Okay? Well, thank you. I took more time at the start than I wanted to, but I think it was the best thing to do.
I'll take one question.
Sorry about that.
Would something like hypnosis make memory recall more accurate?
Hypnosis increases the incidence of false reports. It's wrong. Hypnosis is very highly suggestive. And this is so well known now that in most venues, if you not only have preliminary evidentiary hearings for confessions, but you also have them for eyewitness identification. Preliminary hearing for eyewitness is usually called a Desereaux hearing. Now, it's not unusual, or it used to be not unusual, to attempt to refresh people's memories before they, okay, if they can't remember something, or like an eyewitness identification, for example. And it's so well known that hypnosis increases the false error rate that this usually figures in these hearings now. You'll get these things thrown out. If you've got crucial evidence in an interview or an eyewitness identification and it's been produced through hypnotic refreshment, it's out.
This has been a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.